A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church at Spring Lake, Michigan, on April 14, 1991, in the series Easter People, entitled Doubt, the Other Side of Faith. The scripture readings are John 14, verses 1 through 6, and chapter 20, verses 19 through 29. The text for the sermon is John 20, verses 25 and 28. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
An encounter with the risen Christ is a transforming experience, as Thomas would testify. John uses Thomas as a foil for doubt in the resurrection. But his picture of Thomas over against the risen Christ is consistent with his picture of Thomas throughout the gospel. If you would go to the 11th chapter of the story of the raising of Lazarus before they left for Jerusalem, for Bethany, and to meet there Mary and Martha and to deal with the Lazarus situation, Jesus had waited a while and then finally said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea." And they said, "Lord, just recently they were ready to stone you there." And Jesus said, "Nonetheless." And Thomas said, "Well, let's go with him and die with him." Thomas is the saint of the worst possible scenario. Thomas lived by Murphy's Law. Thomas was convinced that anything that could possibly go wrong would go wrong. Thomas never tuned in to the hour of power to learn the power of possibility thinking. Thomas, in the 14th chapter, becomes the person that raises the question that allows Jesus to come forth with this marvelous statement about being the way and the truth and the life. John consistently portrays Thomas as being just a little bit slow, a little bit dull. All of the disciples were slow of faith and dull of heart, but Thomas becomes the person whose story sort of lifts up that hesitancy to believe, that difficulty to believe, that inability just to let oneself go and to take that leap of faith, to plunge into life with trust and with enthusiasm. He says, "Lord, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way?" And then, of course, on Easter evening, Thomas isn't even with the disciples. Probably one of those persons that has to hurt alone. One of those persons full of despair and sorrow, brokenhearted, who isolates himself, sets himself apart from the fellowship and the community of faith, brooding in his own despair. And as he meets the disciples in the subsequent week, they say, "We've seen the Lord." Now, Thomas wasn't the only one that disbelieved. If you would go through the accounts of the resurrection in all the Gospels, you'll find out that there was fear and dismay and disbelief on the part of them all. After all, resurrection was as unusual then as it would be now. Sometimes we get a rather sophisticated feeling of superiority over against those of the first century. Well, they knew that dead people didn't rise just as we do. It was not any easier for them to accept the fact that one that they had known to be crucified, dead, buried, as the Christian creed emphasized, crucified, dead, buried. I think when I was a kid in the Heidelberg Catechism class, it said, "Why does it say he was buried?" And the answer was, "To show thereby that he was truly dead." I was never too impressed with the profundity of that, but maybe it is profound. He was buried because he was dead. Well, they knew that dead people didn't usually rise and greet them for breakfast. But Thomas becomes the one who exemplifies a great difficulty to believe. Thomas is the patron saint of those who do not come by faith easily. And for such, it's a wonderful thing that Thomas is there in the apostolic band, that one of the chosen ones was also one who had a difficult time believing. Doubt is the other side of faith. And I suppose that Thomas confronts us with the question, is it all right to doubt? Well, I don't know about you, but 100 years or so when I was growing up in the church, I didn't ever get the impression that it was okay to doubt. I got the impression from the pastors in my past that if one doubted, one was skirting with sin, and that one might be taking to oneself a certain load of guilt, that to doubt was to lack faith, which was to be disobedient, which was to become sort of on the periphery, on the margin. One was not sure, if one was a doubter, if there was any room in the assembly of God's people and within the grace of God for one. Doubt was countered. Doubt was not encouraged. Doubt wasn't even allowed, was it? As a young pastor, I didn't allow it. I know that. And yet, the more I think about it, the more I realize that doubt is really the other side of faith. In the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It seems that in the wisdom of God, the only way to come into the experience of God is to trust in God, not in an irrational fashion, which is against human reason, but in a supra-rational fashion that transcends human reason. That's the point. God reveals God's self to faith, to those who trust. And so faith or trust becomes the medium through which I come into the experience of God. And if that is true, then I will always, all of my days, in my walk with God, in my desire and my attempt to believe, I will all my days be vulnerable to doubt. It is not only all right to doubt, it is inevitable that one should doubt. Inevitable because of the very nature of faith, which is the only way to come into peace with God. If it were otherwise, if it were, for example, a possibility of verification, such as is possible in the natural sciences. If you could put it under a microscope, or if you could catch a glimpse of it in a telescope, if you could jam it into a test tube or feed it into a computer, then you would have knowledge, verifiable knowledge. Of course, if we listen to the scientists, the most profound natural scientists of our day, they'll tell you that verifiable knowledge is not quite so certain as it used to be because of the very nature of knowledge itself. But forget that. It is possible in a certain realm of human action to be able to verify, to demonstrate, to prove. But not in the case of religious faith. Not in the case of the soul's quest for God. The way of faith is a way that is always vulnerable to doubt and can always be questioned, because as a matter of fact, faith is not the end of a logical syllogism. Faith is not the compilation of a series of propositions, certain doctrinal statements that all added up, all answered affirmatively, finally come out in a neat package, and one becomes a believer. That's just not the way it is. The very nature of faith itself calls for a commitment of the totality of one's being on that which cannot be humanly demonstrated, verified, proved, or whatever. We walk by faith and not by sight. And Thomas was one of those who inevitably doubted. Because just like doubt is the other side of faith, so there are various kinds of doubters. Thomas was one of those who, as I said, always came up on the gloomy side of things. There are here this morning and everywhere throughout the human family those who have a difficult time trusting, believing. Some of us have no problem with it at all. Some of us find it very difficult to believe. We're all different. And it's not a case of one is good and the other is evil, one is righteous and the other is unrighteous, not that one is loved by God and the other unloved by God. The fact is, we are just all different. And those who have studied the whole development of the human person will tell us that the very early experiences of childhood will predispose one either to fundamental trust or fundamental untrust. There are people in the world who simply have never been able just to let themselves go and entrust themselves. And then there are other people for whom it is just as natural as breathing in and breathing out. The bedrock kind of security of our life is something that we bring to the issue of Jesus Christ. And for some of us, it is very easy. For others, very difficult. There's different kinds of doubt. Some is that constitutional difficulty that a Thomas brings. That wasn't my problem, but I did have a real problem with doubt. It was an intellectual kind of doubt. Some of you are old enough, that's really old, to have been here when I was here the first time. And I used to preach, well, how did I preach? Passionately. pounding the pulpit. And what I did not know then, what I would have denied vehemently then, what I would have discredited eloquently then, was the fact that I was very, very insecure in my faith. And a lot of the energy, and there was energy in the years 60 to 64, but a lot of the energy that exuded all over the place in that former little sanctuary that's now a parlor, a lot of that energy was the opposite side of my own fear that maybe this whole system wasn't as watertight as I wanted it to be. I didn't know that. But eventually the seams began to show, and as I moved to New Jersey, the seams kind of came apart. And I knew that that neat little doctrinal system that I had placed every bit of my life upon was not the kind of foundation that could sustain the human experience that I was gaining and the understanding of life and reality which I was experiencing. And when I went to Europe to study, it wasn't to get a degree. It was to find out whether or not there was a gospel to preach. For me, it was an existential quest. I had all kinds of natural inclination to trust. But for me, warped from the womb, I had to ask, is it true? And I had to look right into the gaping, yawning abyss of naturalistic atheism myself. I had to test it. Maybe you don't have to test it, but I hope you don't have to test it. I had to test it. And I'll tell you this. There is no question that you can raise to the truth of the gospel that I haven't raised first. And it's not easy for me to believe in all of the data of the Christian system. But I'm convinced that the reality to which it points is a place wherein you can rest your soul. Intellectual questions cannot be repressed and put aside. They must be faced honestly, and they can be, without fear. Well, after all of that study over there, I was convinced of the rational defensibility of the Christian system and of its even superiority to the one or two other alternatives, because there are not a lot of alternatives out there. But my life had to be totally devastated for me to realize finally that it's not a matter of solving a matter intellectually, but as the experience, the transforming experience of the grace of the living Lord. And some of you taught me that, the experience of grace, concretely, that transcends all of our doctrinal distinctions and all of our intellectual questions. If you were here on Maundy Thursday, you know that I bore witness on behalf of Jack Steiginga for the week of Holy Week. He was able, after life support systems were removed, to speak. Having been on those life support systems for a week, Jack was able to speak, and speak he did. And he told about the week earlier when all systems began to shut down and his heart failed. And Jack was on the edge between life and death. He was in one of those near-death experiences. He had moved out of the light into the tunnel. He was there and came to a point at which he was unable to turn around and to come back. But he was out of the body. He was conscious of it all, but hardly a participant in any of it. And then having those life support systems for the next week, unable to speak, after having this amazing experience of being in the extremity and being perfectly at peace. And dramatically reinforcing for me my own experience. When he could say, I've been to catechism and Sunday school and Christian school and worship. I know everything I'm supposed to believe. I want to tell you, none of it really matters. Because I know beyond all knowing, beyond all answers, crossing T's and dotting I's, beyond all of the system, anything that you can preach to me or teach me, I know I have been in the abyss. And I have found God is gracious. And there is life. And there is light. And there is nothing, no human experience, not in life or in death, that can ever touch me now. I imagine that's kind of what Thomas must have felt after having made his bold proclamation about what it would take to bring him. The next week, he was there, and Jesus was there, and Jesus offered his hands and laid bare his side. And transcending all of his doubts, out of the depth of his despair, he simply said, My Lord, and my God. You'll never get to a point where you're invulnerable to doubt. But that's okay. Because finally, it's not getting all the answers to your questions, but the experience of the reality of our risen Lord. My Lord and my God. That's all you need.